Welcome to the Muck Reads Podcast. I'm Steve Engelberg, Managing Editor of ProPublica. For this week's episode, we sat down with Sarah Stillman, a freelance journalist and visiting scholar at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, to talk about her recent investigation in The New Yorker entitled The Throwaways. The report lays out how police routinely enlist young offenders as confidential informants with little regard for their safety. I talked with Sarah on Friday, October 5th, for more on this incredible story. Sarah, how'd you get into this?
You know, the story actually began almost 6 years ago now. I was at the gym, weirdly enough, watching Fox News, and they were reporting on Jessica Lunsford, who was this young girl who'd gone missing in Florida. There was a massive search party to find her, and across the bottom of the screen, a little ticker tape said, you know, a body found in the lake was not Jessica. This was like the good news of the day, like, the body's not Jessica, don't worry. And I called the sheriff's office. I said, you know, who was this other body? And they gave me a name. I did a criminal background check, a public records search, and I found that it was a young woman who'd been arrested several times for prostitution, starting when she was very young. So I actually wound up going down to Florida and found this young woman's family, who told me that she'd been working as a confidential informant for the police. And they also said that she had been receiving death threats as a result of doing this really dangerous work and had gone to the police for protection and had received none and ultimately had been found dead. And so, you know, after that, I realized, you know, this issue of confidential informants is probably much broader than we have any idea about.
Well, the case that kind of got to public attention is interesting because it's in many ways typical of the cases that come to public attention. It's a case that doesn't involve a prostitute or a person on the edges of society. So talk a little bit about that. It's the case that opens your story, and obviously it did end up stirring up a great deal of public outrage.
Yeah, I opened with the case of Rachel Hoffman, who was probably sort of demographically atypical for the victims of this tragedy. She was a 23-year-old Florida State graduate, and she had been found with some pot and I think maybe five or six ecstasy pills. She was then told by the police that she could face a really long prison stint, or she could go to work for the police as a confidential informant, going to buy 1,500 ecstasy pills, a stash of cocaine, and a handgun from two convicted felons. So she agreed. She was terrified. She goes off on this mission and ultimately was killed in the midst of the drug buy.
Now, this sort of thing, you know, we see this on television all the time, right? The informant goes out and they have the wire and they have a helicopter in the air and everything is very exciting and works beautifully. What went wrong in this case?
Well, I mean, at every step of the way, there were things that went wrong. I mean, the mission was planned in an area that was densely wooded, and they had a surveillance plane flying overhead, but the plane could actually see almost nothing. The police lost track of her somehow in the midst of the bust. Everyone thought that someone else was tracking her, and ultimately she went off by herself on a road with the dealers. And the wire had been placed in the wrong location. It was in her purse, so it meant that when she went to get the money or when the guys who it turned out were actually there to rob her went to get the money, they found the wires in her purse and one of them shot her.
So just a complete fiasco from beginning to middle to end.
Exactly.
Now, I gather that, as is often the case in these things, her family actually, after a time of being shocked, decided not to take this lying down. So what did they do?
Well, so the family actually decided to pursue a few different avenues. I think the thing they cared about most was actually pushing for legislation to reform the police use of confidential informants, because they were stunned when they looked into the law on this that there really wasn't much. I mean, there wasn't much at all by way of regulations governing, you know, could teenagers be used? Could people in drug treatment programs, which Rachel Hoffman was in, could they be used? So they really set forth the lawyer to really kind of put down, you know, what would basic guidelines for this kind of procedure look like? And they ultimately not only succeeded in passing that law called Rachel's Law in Florida, the first of its kind in the nation, but they also succeeded in bringing a civil suit against the city. And the city ultimately settled for multiple millions and put forth a public apology.
Well, I gather the city had actually reviewed the procedures, and as from your description, it sounds like they followed virtually none of the normal procedures for these things.
I think they did find there were, I believe, upwards of 22 separate violations of policy. But I think what was almost more disturbing was that in many respects, this was pretty standard operating procedure. I think there were a number of unfortunate fiascos, but I think many of the police felt this isn't actually that atypical for, you know, the way we conduct, you know, informant use.
Well, one thing that was striking just looking at the case and reading it, it sounded to me as if, in fact, and she didn't have a lawyer present, that they had lied to her, that she was not going to go do a long jail stint for a few ounces of marijuana. I mean, I guess that's kind of typical in these cases, isn't it?
Part of what's tricky is these people often are not, they haven't even entered the court system often. So they don't even know, you know, what are the real charges I would be facing hypothetically. And also these deals are kind of worked out on the fly, on the spot, without a lawyer, without, often without paperwork. So it means that even in cases like that of Jeremy McLean, another young person who was used in this way and then ultimately killed, he was given a contract and, you know, he said he had to do, I think it was, you know, 4 stings in order to be let off the hook for a charge of selling 8 methadone pills. And so he embarked on this, did these 4 dangerous stings, then was told, well, actually, you know, those resulted in plea bargains rather than trial convictions. So you've got to keep going. So he kept going and going and going. He did, I believe, 13 stings before he was ultimately killed.
And just to be clear, I mean, in situations like this, you know, the typical thing is that the guy, the confidential informant, the CI, goes out to set up a deal. And then immediately the police burst out and bust the person. Does that person have any doubt in their mind as to who the so-called snitch is?
I think that can be a huge problem. I mean, I think in one of the cases I wrote about in Detroit, that was exactly the case. Often it's very transparent who it was that set this person up. It's part of what makes this work so dangerous.
Right. In the case of the gentleman from Vancouver, Washington, Jeremy, it sounds like he had a pretty good idea for a while after he'd set up a dangerous heroin dealer who was let out of jail after a day on bond, that he was in trouble, right? I mean, the parents made it clear. Everybody knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, this was the overarching fact of his life at that point in time. He was, his mother, I think the day the guy got out of jail, Jeremy's mother received a call from him saying, you know, I'm going to come kill your son. So they went to the police. The police said, don't worry about it. This guy's not actually going to kill you. And he continued to receive threats over quite a long period of time and was living in hiding, basically.
Now, Florida's passed this law, and I think that obviously makes the situation look a little bit better in the state of Florida. But what about the other 49 states?
Just to go back really quickly, Florida did end up passing, in some ways, impressive legislation. But in other ways, the legislation was gutted of many of the provisions that Rachel's family cared most about. So they are just now going back to the drawing board, now that attention is back on this case, and saying, why are we still using people who are in drug treatment programs, for instance? I think in most other states, there's very, very little regulation on this.
What about the federal government? The federal government uses a lot of informants. How does that work?
You know, the federal government has significantly more robust kind of regulations around informant use. So that's not to say it's not still terribly dangerous. It's just to say that I believe it was Janet Reno who embarked on this mission to kind of at least put forth a system, not only for ensuring the safety of informants, which, again, is always kind of a tricky proposition, but also for protecting people from the opposite of the informant problem, which is that often unregulated informants are the ones sort of falsely setting people up. There's so many aspects of the system that incentivize, you know, false accusations and other kind of sketchy actions.
Is there a sense from your reporting that a lot of this also stems sort of from the larger cause of the drug laws that we have, that this is, if you're in law enforcement and you want to, quote, make your numbers, this is the easiest way to do it?
No doubt about it. I mean, I think most of the cases I chose to focus on were young people who've been caught with pretty small amounts of drugs. I mean, I mentioned Jeremy had, I think, 8 methadone pills. The young woman in Detroit, Shelley McLean, had less than an ounce of pot. And so often these are people who are going into things that are totally incommensurate with the charges they would have been facing. You know, Rachel buying 1,500 ecstasy pills. And, you know, a number of the families really felt that their children's lives were put on the line in order to help make drug bust quotas that have become pretty onerous for police in certain areas.
So if we had a law enforcement official sitting here right now with us, a sheriff from a county somewhere where they feel that, let's say, methamphetamine use is a very big problem, what would they say? What would their answer be to what you're saying here?
You know, I think law enforcement can make a really compelling and important case for why informants are invaluable in penetrating kind of criminal infrastructure. And I think many police have said, look, like, If there were more clear laws in the books, you know, and we had better procedures for figuring out how do we get to the kingpins, how do we actually use informant policy to move up the chain as opposed to moving kind of sometimes even under on the chain. You know, often we have like little fish chasing after other little fish. And I think what officers are most interested in is how do we actually, you know, get to leadership through informant use.
Talk a little bit about reporting on this story. You have a number of very sort of gripping characters and stories to tell here. What was that like? What were the big challenges in sort of gathering the information for this?
On the one hand, informant use, because it's such a murky world, and by nature, the very term confidential informant, I mean, it's confidential, it's a black box of sort of law enforcement and criminal procedure. That made it, in some respects, really difficult to find some of the kinds of cases I was looking for. You know, I mentioned, you know, the body that was found in the lake that was not Jessica. I mean, had I not scratched a little deeper there, I think that case would have gone down in the books as, you know, a drug-related incident. We would never know actually how many cases are there that involve this sort of informant abuse. On the other hand, I found, you know, when I started digging through legal complaints, I was finding, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens. The hardest part was really narrowing it down because I spoke to so many families who had experienced real tragedy, real loss. And one reporting challenge was just, you know, how do I fit in as many different characters as I can here? And how do I deal with the fact that, you know, all of them aren't going to make it in? That's hard.
Of course. You know, I'm just curious, are the court records, once a case like this has gone awry, do they try to keep the court records themselves confidential? I mean, the police records of what went on?
Exactly. So almost always these things are entirely sealed. So I found ways to use the Freedom of Information Act to get around some of that. You know, there were instances where I could pursue the court records of the person who had been ratted out as opposed to the person who was the informant. And often you can actually put together a surprising and sort of scary amount of information on an informant that way.
You know, one thing just reading this that occurred to me, and I was sort of curious if you came across this, I would think that in the world of law enforcement, if an informant was killed, that would be something that you would want to punish swiftly and surely. Otherwise, who wants to be an informant? Does law enforcement take this kind of crime, you know, usually seriously, or how did you get the sense of that?
I think it'd be hard to make an overarching statement on that. In the cases I looked at, it was really the opposite. Because there had been sort of law enforcement wrongdoing, I think there was a real desire to push these cases under the rug. But, you know, I think it probably varies. I think in some of the cases, like the case in Kentucky, the officer involved felt it had been a tragedy, and he went to the family and he apologized. And, you know, I think it really, there are probably quite a few upstanding officers who realize that people, these informants, are their assets and they need to be protected.
So in your story, it's clear that there are some what we might call nice kids who get tied up in this and are obviously in way over their heads. You know, one could imagine that that's just because those are the families that bring lawsuits. But what did your reporting tend to indicate about that?
What was surprising to me at first is, as I went through all of these different legal cases, probably upwards of 20 cases where people were suing families on behalf of their loved ones who've been killed in this way, particularly their children, I found there was a surprising number of sort of upper middle class families that were surfacing. And, you know, of course, my first hypothesis was, you know, these are the people who have the resources to bring a lawsuit. I think I've also found, though, that in many cases, the people who have been sort of who found themselves in this circumstance are the ones who perceive themselves as having the most to lose. So there are actually quite a few college students with families that have more resources who nonetheless, you know, they're terrified of telling their parents, they're really worried and ashamed, and so they go to do pretty dangerous drug stings. And that was a surprise to me. But I think, you know, conversely, we're probably seeing tons and tons of cases in sort of low-income communities where families don't necessarily have a way to, you know, push back against law enforcement or to find a lawyer to pursue something more.
I suppose it's also possible that in some of those communities, the reality of what it might mean to be caught as a snitch is more clear and present.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you saw that in Baltimore, there was, you know, a DVD that was circulated, Stop Snitching, that became this big phenomenon that became like everywhere from graffiti to rap music lyrics. Just that was the mantra, you know, if you snitch, you will be killed. And I think that in many urban communities, that's the reality. And that's a well-known reality.
And I guess, sadly, the other thing is the threat of being thrown into the system and being put in jail, you know, may be less unfamiliar in those communities, right? You have incarceration rates in some places approaching 50%, right? So you have a completely different viewpoint on what's dangerous and what isn't dangerous.
Exactly. Cases where, you know, police presence is also just so pervasive that these things are almost normalized.
And I guess there may also be an assumption, which, as your story suggests, is not always the case, that these upper middle class kids have a sense that the police are basically there to help them.
I think in Rachel's case, there was definitely a kind of naive approach. That's how her parents characterized it, to, you know, the good faith efforts of, you know, if I do this, then in fact my charges will be let off and, you know, this officer's telling me the truth, which, you know, I think perhaps was called into question.
Well, it's a very well done story, Sarah, very powerful. What kind of response have you gotten on this? What's happened since the story appeared in The New Yorker?
I've gotten quite a number of emails from people saying, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, tons of emails from people who have worked in some capacity as an informant or who had family members who found themselves in this situation. And also some from law enforcement who've said that they're dealing with these challenges and from legislators who've said, you know, what would it look like to, you know, govern this a little more systematically?
Well, one simple thing, which is interesting that you don't really see being adopted, it would certainly make some sense to take the federal rules and essentially apply them to state law enforcement. Why hasn't anybody come to that conclusion?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's sort of odd that a field that's this dangerous, this, you know, no one would argue that this isn't incredibly, you know, potentially lethal work. So the question of why it remains so, you know, widely, certain facets of it remain so widely unregulated is kind of, you know, bizarre.
Well, Sarah Stillman, thank you very much. Great story.
Thanks.